Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Hospitals targeted in Syria. Doctors Without Borders says one of its hospitals was destroyed while three other medical facilities were damaged in northern Syria by what rebels battling the Assad government claim were targeted airstrikes by the regime. Medics and witnesses say at least 10 people were killed at a maternity and pediatric clinic hit by missiles and rockets in the border town of Azaz. The charity group also said its 30-bed hospital was destroyed and 7 people killed in Idlib province. The group, known by its French initials MSF, said the hospital was hit 4 times in 2 attacks, leaving at least 8 staff members missing. VOA's Jamie Detmer was at the hospital in Kilis, Turkey, where the victims' families are as confused as they are frustrated.
And outside the hospital, there's a lot of anger amongst particularly the relatives and other Syrian refugees who feel that we have had these strikes a few days after there's talk of a cessation of hostilities, but the airstrikes by the regime, people believe these airstrikes were carried out by the regime, just continue and the deaths mount up.
British Foreign Minister Philip Hammond.
The Russians can end this if they want to. They can make this cessation of hostilities work by scaling back their bombing and redirecting it against the real terrorists rather than bombing the moderate opposition. But if the Russians think that the moderate opposition are going to lay down their weapons while they carry on bombing moderate opposition positions, they're wrong. That's not going to happen.
Meanwhile, Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu said Monday his country will not let Syrian Kurdish fighters take down the town of Azaz, located a few kilometers south of its border. Syria accused Turkey of sending ground troops into Aleppo province on Saturday. This is VOA News. Well, U.S. President Barack Obama is set to welcome the leaders of all 10 Association of Southeast Asian Nations to a historic summit in California on Monday, where he will seek to implement his U.S. rebalancing strategy with the Asia-Pacific on a path that would reach decades into the future. Mr. Obama and the ASEAN leaders will meet for 2 days at the scenic Sunnyland Retreat in Rancho Mirage, where a more informal agenda is planned to discuss a range of critical and thorny issues central to the U.S. Pivot to the region. The ball is now in the court of Libya's internationally recognized parliament in Tobruk to approve or vote down a newly named 18-member government. Edward Uranium reports for VOA from Cairo.
Arab media reported tensions during a parliament debate Monday on whether to approve the government proposed by Prime Minister-designate Fayez al-Sarraj. He insists the new 18-member cabinet is broadly based, though it is smaller than a 32-minister panel voted down by Parliament last month. Sarraj says the new ministerial council is composed of 13 ministers with portfolios and 5 ministers of state. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Officials say the cabinet will represent a new beginning for Libya and an end to the conflict so that all Libyans can unite in their efforts to battle the country's sole enemy, which is terrorism. Witnesses in the Somali capital say a car bomb explosion has killed the country's former defense minister. A police officer at the scene said the bomb had been planted underneath the car of Muhyiddin Mohamed Haji Ibrahim. He's the former defense minister who was working as an advisor for the Somali parliament. The blast occurred Monday in Mogadishu's KM4 neighborhood. Authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo briefly detained prominent opposition figure Martin Fayulu on Sunday, 2 days before a general strike designed to pressure President Joseph Kabila to step down from office. Citizens are being asked to stay home on Tuesday to demand elections to be held within the constitutional framework. Vote counting has begun in the Central African Republic in the presidential runoff election between 2 former prime ministers who pledged to bring peace and security to the nation. Alima Zainabu Chaibu is a Bangui resident. She says, "We want change, and this change will improve many things so that peace can return and Muslims and Christians can live together once again like they used to." The winner will replace a transitional government put into place in 2014 when President Francis Bozize was pushed from office. For more on all these stories, visit our website at voanews.com. This is Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A new Human Rights Watch report released Monday says hundreds of women and girls still bear the physical and mental scars of sexual violence following Kenya's post-election turmoil in 2007 and 2008. The report says the government has not helped them.
That's VOA's Jill Craig reporting details coming up. Also in the news, there were more grenade attacks in Burundi's capital Bujumbura today, killing a child and wounding at least 30 people. And a former Somali defense minister was killed today in a car bomb explosion in Mogadishu. We have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Algeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, there were more grenade attacks in Burundi's capital Bujumbura today, killing a child and wounding at least 30 people. The French news agency says men on motorbikes threw three grenades in the business center. Two other explosions were reported in the northern suburb of the capital. Grenade explosions are a frequent occurrence in the city. No one has claimed responsibility. Security forces and rebels blame each other for the violence. Hundreds have died in violence in Burundi that was triggered by President Nkurunziza's announcement last April that he would seek a third term. Critics say his re-election violated the constitution and the Arusha peace accords. About 250,000 Burundians have fled to neighboring countries. Meanwhile, the Council of the European Union has released a statement on Burundi. It says the lack of the prospect for a political solution increases the risk of violent confrontation. It warns the situation is likely to get worse because of the country's fragile economy. The EU Council also says any individual involved in acts of violence and serious human rights violations, including incitement of hatred, must be held responsible. It's been 9 months since a foiled coup in Burundi. In response, the government closed many radio stations, accusing them of siding with the coup plotters. So far, none of the closed radio stations has reopened. From Bujumbura, Moses Havyarimana has the story.
It was May 13th last year when popular private radio stations were attacked and others torched during the confrontation between government forces and coup plotters. That period was a turning point for the independent stations, leaving the public with only the state-owned radio and some private radio stations. They continue to broadcast by not criticizing the government. Ishari Giramahoro is the chairman of the Burundi Media Council. He said that since the failed coup d'etat on 13th of May 2015, there were at least four private media that stopped operating. And since that moment, the Attorney General opened judicial investigations to learn whether those medias or journalists played a role in the past event, most especially the failed coup d'etat. Earlier last week, the Burundi Attorney General issued a letter to extradite 35 individuals in exile who are accused of involvement in the plan to overthrow the government. Among the 35 individuals, including two private media owners whose media houses were banned and closed. Patrice Vahard is a UN Human Rights Commissioner in Burundi. He said that independent media is healthy for a democracy and called on the Burundi government to consider reopening the stations.
Historically, it is well established that radio has been the driving force for positive change. Although I understand the political context in which some radios were suspended, that have continuously appealed to the authorities to rather consolidate the democratic gain they have had over the past 10 years in having free press, to consider reopening the radio, because I see them as agent of development, agent of peace.
Burundi Media Council Chairman Giramahoro talks about the government position on reopening the banned media.
Vous savez que à partir du coup d'état raté le 13 mai,
he said that the government has a goodwill and supports press freedom and freedom of expression throughout the media. He said, recently, the President of the Republic, during his public conference, expressed his goodwilling of efforts for the media that are not accused of some crimes or have no case in the country's judicial body to be reopened as soon as possible. Most Burundians have resorted to social media in efforts to get or disseminate information and news rather than rely on the state broadcaster or news from independent outlets that are censored. United Nations Human Rights Representative Patrice Vahard says the international community hopes the government will work to ensure an independent press.
Where we are, we can only advocate and call on the wisdom and the indulgence of the authorities to positively look into this. And I'm optimistic that this call is not in vain. We do respect the position. The timing is certainly up to them. But clearly, I think everybody has this nostalgia about the time not long ago when we had so many radio stations that were capable of broadcasting.
The Burundi government has promised to reopen two of the five closed radio stations. Although Rema FM and Isanganiro Radio will be reopened, there are still problems for press freedom advocates. Two media chiefs, one with African Public Radio RPR and another with Renaissance Radio and TV, are on the attorney's list of people to be extradited to Burundi for their alleged role in the attempted coup. Human rights activists fear that if they are returned, they would not face a fair trial. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
A former Somali defense minister was killed today in a car bomb explosion in Mogadishu. VOA Somali service reports Mohadin Mohammed Haji Ibrahim was an advisor to the Somali parliament. A bomb planted under his car exploded in the capital's KM4 neighborhood. No one has yet claimed responsibility for the blast, but Al-Shabaab militants are suspected. Last week, Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for a bomb attack that tore a hole in a passenger plane shortly after takeoff from Mogadishu. In related news, a Nigerian newspaper reports Somalia's president is saying some of Nigeria's Boko Haram militants were trained by Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Vanguard Online says President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud made the comment yesterday at a security conference in Germany. The Somali leader is quoted as saying, without a stable Somalia, the whole region of the Horn of Africa will remain unstable and by and large, the African continent. Also, the Cameroon military says a commander and one soldier were killed yesterday when their convoy hit a landmine while traveling in Nigeria. The Cameroon Army unit was returning home after conducting cross-border raids against suspected Boko Haram bomb-making factories near Goshi in Nigeria. A new Human Rights Watch report released today says hundreds of women and girls still bear the physical and mental scars of sexual violence following Kenya's post-election turmoil in 2007 and 2008. The report says the government has not helped them. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Human Rights Watch says some 900 women and girls were victims of sexual violence during the post-election period, and many cases likely were unreported. The group says lack of medical attention left many survivors unable to work or pursue an education and stuck in poverty. Jacqueline Mutere alleges a neighbor's friend forcefully entered her house, pretending to seek refuge from the violence.
He started the pushing and shoving. He started making advances at me, and I refused them. They had my small kids in the room, in the house they were sleeping. And I wasn't going to accept his advances. And with brute force, no way. And so he became violent, extremely violent. Slapped me around a few times, actually. He burst my eardrum.
HRW's Agnes Othiombo is senior researcher for women's rights in Africa and interviewed survivors for the report.
Women have a lot of injuries, back injuries, leg injuries, chest injuries, because the rapes were just so brutal. They included, you know, kicking women, slapping them, cutting them with machetes, pulling legs apart.
She says victims also suffered mentally.
Women were talking about having sleepless nights, not being able to concentrate at work because they keep thinking about the rape. And let's not forget that these women were not just raped, they were also affected just like other victims of the post-election violence by losing their homes, losing their loved ones, husbands, children in the violence.
Othiombo says many victims were gang raped by anywhere from 4 to at least 10 men, at times in front of family members, including young children, and were stigmatized by their husbands and communities. Some women contracted sexually transmitted diseases, became pregnant, or both. Because abortion is illegal in Kenya, even in rape cases, some women obtained so-called backstreet or back alley abortions that left them with severe internal damage. Those who carried their pregnancies to term faced additional abuse and discrimination, as did their children. When women reported their rapes, they were often told to find their perpetrator and bring him to the police, or were accused of lying for political reasons. The government has acknowledged rapes occurred during that period, but has not offered assistance to the victims. Human Rights Watch is urging the government to use its restorative justice fund of about $9.8 million announced last March to help survivors, especially those urgently needing medical and psychosocial services. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Sixteen past the hour, you are listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Four countries in Central Europe are meeting today to discuss building a fence to seal off the major path for migrants and refugees entering Europe from Greece. The fence would block them entering Macedonia and Bulgaria. The International Office for Migration says despite severe winter weather, the flow of migrants and refugees from Turkey to Greece is about 2,000 per day. That's more than 10 times the number of entries during the same time last year. Since January 1st, more than 400 have died in boat tragedies on the Aegean. Last week, the UN Secretary General released a draft report ahead of the World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul in May. The report urges world leaders to take greater responsibility in preventing conflict. It also appeals to leaders and relief agencies to leave no one behind, including minorities, the handicapped, and older people. The group Help Age International welcomed the report's recognition of the plight of the aging, but would have liked to see more details on their needs. Marcus Skinner is the humanitarian advisor for the group HelpAge International, which fights for the rights of older people. Reporter William Eagle asked him for his reaction on the report.
I mean, I think the first thing to say is that HelpAge, I mean, we're pleased to see the recognition in the report of the exclusion of older people within humanitarian assistance, and some of the commitments made are ambitious around the collection of data and the tracking of progress of the most vulnerable. I think for us, one of the disappointments was that the meta trend of global aging and the implications for humanitarian response aren't adequately considered across the board. So, for example, while there's a strong element of the work of the report on women's empowerment and gender-based violence, within that there's very little consideration of the risks that older women face. And we know that due to the nature of aging, there are many more older women than there are older men, and that within that there are risks and vulnerabilities that they face. And so that's a major gap for us. And then again, in relation to discussion, for example, around discrimination faced by persons with disability, we know that there's a significant overlap between aging and disability, but the theme of aging isn't picked up within that. So although overall we're very glad to see the recognition, we think that there's progress that could be made in terms of almost mainstreaming considerations of aging throughout some of the other themes of the summit documents.
The press release for your group mentioned that the consequences for humanitarian work was not considered. Are there other consequences for those bringing relief that need to be known about older people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a major issue in relation to the implications of global aging for humanitarian assistance as populations and those affected by emergencies age. It has implications for the type of humanitarian assistance that needs to be delivered and the manner in which it's delivered. So, for example, the delivery of healthcare needs to better consider the presence of what are called non-communicable diseases, so things like diabetes or high blood pressure, which, although not traditionally seen as life-threatening, are in fact life-threatening for those when treatment is interrupted. More practically, we often see the distribution of humanitarian goods and food. And if you don't consider the risks and challenges that older people and those with limited mobility face in accessing that assistance, it's very hard to ensure that the assistance you provide reaches the most vulnerable, and particularly older people. So I think a lot of this is known to humanitarians, and the challenge that we face is turning that into concrete action and changes to the way in which assistance is delivered.
You mentioned the concerns of your group for humanitarian aid to older people in terms of, for example, medical issues, that older people suffer from diabetes, high blood pressure. And you also mentioned distribution of food. What is the issue with distribution of food? Is it not given by relief workers to everyone equally?
I think there's two challenges with food distribution. One is that centralized distributions are often, unless adaptations are made, are often hard to access for older people. If you imagine if you have limited mobility or you have challenges with vision or hearing, standing in a queue all day to wait for a large packet of food that then you have to carry back to your shelter or home becomes an enormous challenge. And so often older people and other vulnerable groups such as people with disability just don't attend distributions and therefore don't access assistance. So while the objective is to provide blanket assistance to everyone who's affected, the reality is without identifying and recognizing the challenges that certain groups face, it's very hard to fulfill that commitment. And then the second challenge with food distribution specifically is often the types of food that are distributed. So if you imagine older people will often have issues with dental loss of teeth and dental issues, and therefore may have trouble chewing or even digesting certain foods. And so if they're provided a blanket distribution of foods that aren't appropriate for them and their diet, then even if they do receive the assistance, they're not receiving the benefits of the humanitarian aid as it's designed.
Is HelpAge and other NGOs involved in maybe lobbying those who will be attending the summit or those who are arranging the agenda of the summit to include more focus on those who are aging?
We're working with a group of leading humanitarian organizations to put in place a side event at the summit which will look at issues of the exclusion of vulnerable groups from humanitarian assistance. And so our lobbying agenda for the World Humanitarian Summit is really to raise the profile of older people as part of a wider initiative to ensure that humanitarian assistance is accessible to everyone who needs it.
That was Marcus Skinner, the humanitarian advisor for the group HelpAge International. He spoke to VOA's William Eagle. The world is feeling the effects of climate change, with some regions experiencing persistent droughts and others being hit by floods. A team of scientists is measuring how fast climate change is occurring and what the future climate might be like by looking at ancient samples of sediment beneath the ocean floor. Columbia University geology professor Sidney Hemming is a leader of a group of 29 scientists aboard a research vessel on the Indian Ocean, drilling beneath the seabed floor of the South African coast. They are analyzing the sediment samples to examine 5 million years of climate history. From the vessel sailing the Indian Ocean, Hemming spoke to VOA's Adam Phillips about the research.
The reason we're interested in that is because we want to understand how the climate on land nearby in Africa is related to how the ocean works. And we also are really interested in climate in Africa because of the climate controls on human evolution.
So you collect these cores. How deep do you have to go in meters in order to get a sample that's 5 million years old? And give me an example of how the composition of that core can tell you specific things.
They're about 200 to 350 meters that we're estimating is going to give us 5 million years of history. And microorganisms, calcium carbonate organisms, make the sediment white, and river sediments make the sediments more brown or gray. And so light, dark layers help us to understand climate cycles just from a first-order observation of the cores. In a really simple-minded way, you could think of it as they're telling us about how much runoff there is from the rivers, how rainy it was. The more rainy it is, the more the rivers are going to bring the sediment into the ocean, right? So there's going to be more of the darker, terrigenous material in times when the river runoff is greater.
And then you'll be correlating the archaeological record with the climate record and seeing if climate had any effect on the evolution of the animals that you found there, including humans?
Yes. The data that exists so far seems to show a real connection between times when it's wet or dry and the archaeological records. That would be the ultimate goal. If we can take advantage of what's already known about the evolutionary history in Africa and couple that with what we can discern about the climatic history, then we can already start making some really pretty profound inferences about how these things are connected. The environment makes a big difference, and the biggest factor in the environment is probably how much water there is available. There seems to be a really good connection between evidence like higher lake levels or greater runoff from the rivers or more water in the cave deposits and so forth. Everything seems to point to water being a really pretty important factor in where communities develop. And there are several sort of broader hypotheses about that. There are people that think that variability in climate may be an important factor, and there are people that think stability. These will be exciting records because of those kinds of questions that there's not uniform agreement about. And there's many different kinds of measurements that are emerging that are allowing marine sediments to be a good archive. So we've got several people on board that have different expertise that are, you know, looking at different aspects of what the land's bringing to the ocean. But the other thing that's exciting about being in these sites is the ocean side of the question, right? We're also going to hopefully be able to say something more profound about the connection between how the ocean works and how the climatic changes on Africa work. And that just informs more about just how the whole Earth's climate system works in general.
And of course, changes in human evolution or primate evolution would be affected by the climate and, of course, may help predict how humans will fare in the future.
Yes, absolutely. That would be one of the real driving motivations for paleoclimate studies in general, is that we know we're making a big change in the climate system today, but in order to really predict it, we need a longer record of how the system responds, so it gives us a much longer timescale perspective. It allows us to sort of see a greater range of behavior of the climate system.
Wow, you've got big problems. I like that.
Big problems and fun problems, but there's 30 of us. I can tell you that you can feel the excitement building up already, because it's, you know, it's pretty cool to have the possibility of tapping down that far back in Earth's history and really getting a chance to understand how things change. It's definitely very exciting.
Good luck to you. I mean, I really wish you smooth sailing, and I hope that you get everything you're looking for and more.
Thank you very much.
That was VOA's Adam Phillips in New York speaking with geologist Sidney Hemming of Columbia University's Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Next on Let's Talk, rumors. Millions are paid to athletes, singers, and actors for their work. Celebrities, do they earn too much money? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing rumors. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the Uganda presidential elections with Shaka Sali in Uganda and me, Esther Gidu Yuart, as the studio guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. More grenade attacks in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura, today, killing a child and wounding at least 30 people. And a former Somali defense minister was killed today in a car bomb in Mogadishu. Coming up, music from Algeria. And in our feature segment, mental illness grossly underestimated worldwide. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Sporty greetings, Yehiz.
Sunny, I understand you have some Olympic news for us.
Yehiz, let's begin with Olympic news. In Kenya, refugees from other African countries are training at a special camp and competing for a limited number of slots in this year's Rio Games under the flag of the International Olympic Committee. As Lenny Ruvaga reports from Ngong, this is a first in Olympic history.
20 kilometers from Kenya's capital, Nairobi, sits Ngong, where today a select group of athletes is training for a chance to run in the Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, this August. The athletes, who number around 30, are all refugees from various war-torn countries in Africa. They're training at the Teglalarupe Training Center for Refugee Athletes. 20-year-old Rose Nadike from South Sudan is one such athlete. She runs the 800 and 1,500 meters. For the last 16 years, Nadike has been living at the Kakuma refugee camp in northwestern Kenya, along with her siblings. The huge camp hosts about 200,000 refugees from Eritrea, Congo, South Sudan, Somalia, Ethiopia, Uganda, and Rwanda. Nafika says life in the camp is hard.
Before we came here, we had been facing a lot of challenges due to the hot weather in Kakuma, and the place is too dry that we cannot able to stay, but we adapt the situation where you are.
Now she and the other athletes in Ngong train twice a day, beginning each session with 45 minutes of warm-up exercises before starting their workouts. Dawood Abubakar fled Somalia in 1998. He's been training at the camp for the last 5 months and hopes to run in the Olympics 5,000 and 10,000 meter races. He says the chance to compete under the Olympic flag and the training camp itself have improved his prospects.
You know, when we were in the camps, you don't get time. But now most of us, we are improving time. We have got good time. We have got good coaches. You know, the way that you train, when you are in the camps, you can't train the way that you want. You are alone, just you go and you come back. But here we get coaches.
With the help of national Olympic committees, the International Olympic Committee is identifying a select few refugee athletes for the Games. Kipchoge Keino, a two-time Olympic gold medalist himself, chairs the Kenyan Olympic Committee. He told VOA there will be high standards for qualification.
The training is going to be very hard. You might find some training with our athletes in some of our training camps. And this is the most important. We want to encourage them, those talented, to be able to perform well.
In a few months, some of these athletes may make history by running in Rio under the flag of the IOC. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Ngong, Kenya.
Hello, sports fans. This is Paul Tergat, marathon champion from Kenya. You are listening to the Sony side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Meanwhile, Kenyan athletes took the top four places at the Los Angeles Marathon in Southern California on Sunday. Weldon Kirui was the overall winner in 2 hours, 13 minutes and 6 seconds. He was followed across the finish line by Kenyan countrymen Willie Cortile, Daniel Limo, and Jacob Chemtai. Also in Los Angeles over the weekend, the United States held its Olympic marathon trials. At stake, three places in the men's marathon and three places in the women's marathon at the Rio Olympics in Brazil in August. Amy Cragg won the women's race in 2 hours, 28 minutes, and 20 seconds. Desiree Linden and Shalane Flanagan finished second and third, and they're also going to Rio. This is the fourth time Flanagan has made the U.S. Olympic team. In the men's race, Galen Rupp made his marathon debut in victorious fashion, clocking 2 hours, 11 minutes, and 12 seconds. Rupp won a silver medal at 10,000 meters at the 2012 London Olympics, and he says he might run both the 10,000 meters and the marathon in Rio de Janeiro. Eritrea-born Meb Keflezighi and Jared Ward earned the two other Olympic places on the U.S. men's marathon team. Like Flanagan, this marks the fourth time Meb has made the U.S. Olympic team, and at age 40, he becomes the oldest U.S. Olympic marathon runner ever. Meb was very emotional after qualifying in Los Angeles.
Running has changed my life. And I feel so blessed to touch people's life. And I grabbed the United States flag. It was just victory lap for me to be able to come. And knowing that I'm going to make the team, knowing that I, you know, fourth time, like I said, my daughter Johanna and the United States and nieces, there's a lot of people that are, you know, Ryan Shea wasn't my thought. Because I have an ill mother who was my second mom. Blaze. From Dallas, who was a 4 days, had a heart surgery. Those things are going in my mind, you know, stuff. I have a niece who has pneumonia who's going to be here, but he just try to draw energy and be the best that he can and dig deep. And you got to celebrate life because we have this able body, you know. A lot of people love to be for an our position going through. And we have this able body. That's what I try to do. And that's why it was a happy moment for me. And there's a lot of people that love to be in my position, and they can't because illness, disease, and other things.
Celebrating life and celebrating his fourth Olympic berth, that's Meb Keflezighi. In addition to his silver medal in the marathon at the 2004 Athens Olympics, Meb won the 2009 New York City Marathon and the 2014 Boston Marathon. Joining us again on the sunny side of sports is Andrew Palcheski, the voice of America's social media reporter. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sonny.
What's trending in the sports world, Andrew?
Well, I'll start with the story you just touched on with Meb. Meb is one of those people in the U.S. who, in a sport that is not very widely followed in marathon running and long distance running, has kind of picked up this following, and you see that on social media. So part of the reason I think he's getting so emotional is because of that strong support that he has. So in a sport, like I said, it's not a, you know, Major League Baseball or NBA. It's kind of a solitary sport of running, but
right.
He has a great amount of support on social media.
And I think being an Olympic year, a lot of people are probably wondering what's he going to do at the age of 40.
Exactly. There's a lot of things, you know, parallels even to when we've talked about last week, Peyton Manning being 39 and winning the Super Bowl. I think
That's
a lot
right.
of people saying he's 40 years old. We want Meb to win, and we want him to go out and get the gold for the U.S. So excitement over that for sure.
What else is trending, Andrew?
Well, the NBA All-Star Game this weekend was trending all through the weekend and into today for a few big reasons. Probably the chief among them is that the West beat the East 196-173, making it the highest scoring NBA
wow.
All-Star game in history.
So not a lot of defense being played in Toronto.
Not a lot of defense, as opposed, you know, we had the Super Bowl last week here in the U.S. It was kind of a defensive battle between
right.
the Panthers and the Broncos. This was an offensive rout, if you could call it that. It's just these huge numbers being put up. Lots of players in double digits on scoring. Just people following along with that in amazement, really, because that's not a score that you would necessarily see for a professional
no,
basketball
no.
game.
Maybe in pinball.
Maybe something like that, or, you know, if it was, I don't know what. But a lot of excitement over that. A lot of excitement, of course, because it's Kobe Bryant's last All-Star game. He's retiring this year. So.
And I remember we saying last week that Kobe probably has one of the most followers on Twitter.
Yeah, 8.6 million. It's probably gone up since then. Probably 8.7 or 8.8 now, at least.
So probably a few tweets about Kobe
absolutely.
Over the weekend.
We saw a lot of the tributes. They did a very nice tribute on the Jumbotron before the game, and that was shared across social media and Twitter video. And so that was getting a lot of feelings stirred up on social media that this is Kobe's last game and that he's had such a long career and a great career in the NBA.
Who were some of the other stars in this NBA All-Star game, Andrew?
Well, we had Russell Westbrook was the MVP for the second consecutive year, scoring 31 points for the West. So a lot of people talking about him on social media for sure. And then also Paul George for the East, 41 points.
Wow.
He was the most for any player, East or West. But then you had other things that were trending on social media in addition to the game. For example, I saw one tweet about all the different sneakers that all the different players are wearing and pictures of those. So you have those, you know, the celebrities that were there, both basketball celebrities and music celebrities, actors, those kind of things. A lot of people talking about that.
I imagine the shoe manufacturers always like it when, let's say, an Adidas or Nike tweet goes out. They love that.
Absolutely. And the companies are now getting savvy about that. So you'll see Nike and Adidas and other companies using their social media to publicize, hey, we have these players in the game that are wearing our merchandise.
Andrew, this was the first time the NBA has held its All-Star game outside the United States. Did you get a sense on social media that the Canadians embrace basketball and maybe that we'll see an All-Star game maybe in London or another country in years to come?
It's certainly possible. It's something that Major League Baseball's talked about, that the National Football League has talked about here in the U.S., moving a team overseas or to a different country. I thought it was very interesting with the celebrity All-Star game where you had all these professional actors and musicians and athletes from other sports playing that you had a lot of great ambassadors, Canadian ambassadors for the sport. Drake was the coach of Team Canada, which ended up winning, beating Team US 74-64.
Okay.
But you had the other thing that I was very interested in because I'm a big tennis fan was Milos Raonic and Eugenie Bouchard, male and female tennis players from Canada, participated in this celebrity game. So it'd be interesting to see if they almost become ambassadors to say, hey, we want another NBA team here in Canada. We want to expand the league, much as it is for the National Hockey League. There are quite a few teams there in Canada, so maybe expand more for the NBA.
And speaking of the NBA, Andrew, I want to give a quick shout-out for one of my favorite players, John Wall of the Washington Wizards, the only Wizard in that All-Star game. He played pretty well, I think, overall.
He did. He had about 20 minutes of playing time, and with that time scored 22 points. So he did very well for himself. One of the many players who are sharing their moments from the game on social media, both before the game and then after.
Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Thanks for joining us, Andrew, and I guess I'll see you again on Wednesday.
We'll see you Wednesday.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yehias Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny, and thank you, Andrew. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, mental illness grossly underestimated worldwide. And next, a state-of-the-art electronics facility in Nairobi. But first some music. Here is Idira Nadia from Algeria with Amon Père.
Toujours comme la racine de notre feu. famille, tu es ma fille.
À mon père, j'ai à dire tellement de choses. À mon père, cet homme libre, loin de sa terre. À mon père, qui sans lire et sans écrire a su faire de sa vie mon devenir.
C'est par toi que survit mon patrimoine. C'est par toi, citoyenne, que je m'élève. C'est pour toi que je t'ai mes sentiments par amour pour ma foi et mon enfant.
Tu sais, ben, il y a des choses entre une fille et son père qui ne se disent pas chez nous. Mais une chose est sûre, c'est que tu m'as toujours dit d'inspecter les autres et de travailler dur, dur pour aller toujours plus loin, toujours plus haut. Et tu m'as rendue citoyenne du monde.
Parce que Zéram se veut d'être l'homme libre, tu porteras ce nom comme on porte le destin. C'est un peu de moi, même si je ne te le dis pas. Je suis entre tes mains comme l'eau sacrée d'un pays. Citoyenne de ce monde, ta vie sera ma vie.
Mon patrimoine, c'est pour toi, citoyenne, que je m'élève. C'est pour toi que je t'ai mes sentiments par amour pour ma foi et mon enfant.
À mon père, j'ai à dire tellement de choses.
À mon père,
cet homme libre, roi de sa terre, qui sans lire et sans écrire a su faire de sa vie mon devenir.
C'est par toi que survit mon patrimoine, c'est pour toi, citoyenne, que je m'élève. C'est pour toi que je t'ai mes sentiments par amour pour ma foi et mon enfant.
À mon père, j'ai à dire tellement de choses. À mon père, cet homme libre, loin de sa terre. À mon père.
Idira Nadia from Algeria with A Mon Père. The number of people living with mental illness worldwide is grossly underestimated, according to the authors of a new study. They say the true numbers are masked by other health problems. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
The global disease burden associated with mental illness is underestimated by more than a third. That's according to researchers at Harvard University and University College London, who say mental illness accounts for 32% of all disability worldwide. Previously, mental illness was thought to be responsible for 21% of global disability. The authors say people with other health problems, such as heart disease, pain syndromes, neurological problems, and HIV, often suffer from psychiatric disorders that go unrecognized by the medical profession. Clinical depression often goes along with chronic illness, but is rarely reported and treated, according to the authors. Daniel Vigo, a psychiatrist and fellow at Harvard School of Public Health in Boston, says psychiatric disorders exact a high human cost.
People with mental illness die up to 30 years before their peers. People with mental illness die before a heavy smoker, just to have a perspective on how serious this is.
Part of the problem, says Vigo, is the stigma that accompanies mental illness. People with psychiatric disorders are more likely to avoid doctors and treatment than people who are physically ill. He says the percentage of people who are being treated for mental disorders, about 8% of the U.S. population, is only the beginning. Vigo and colleagues are calling for greater recognition of the problem by the global community and for treatment for psychiatric conditions to be offered at the primary care level, where many people with other health problems are seen.
Mental health service needs to evolve and not be considered as a separate issue anymore. And there are a number of evidence-based interventions that are being piloted or applied at a larger scale in many both developed and developing countries that sort of show the way that this can be done.
Treatments that can be offered through primary care include both medication and therapy. But first, Vigo says it's important for countries to recognize a problem exists. In April, a mental health summit will take place in Washington in conjunction with the annual meeting of the World Bank. An article by Daniel Vigo and colleagues on the scope of the global mental health problem is published in the journal The Lancet Psychiatry. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
In In Nairobi, Kenya, a non-profit organization called Gearbox offers a unique space for engineers and inventors to showcase their innovative ideas. VOA's Paul Ndiho tells us about the state-of-the-art facility that is dedicated to the fabrication of industrial electronics.
Launched last year, Gearbox used its laboratories, combined its resources and talent to help African innovators learn how to move ideas more rapidly from the lab to the marketplace. It's generating a buzz in Nairobi. Gearbox provides a platform for innovative youth to harness their artistic skills in computer technology towards building a more robust and powerful electronics manufacturing sector in Kenya. Dr. Kamau Gachiji is the Chief Executive Director, Gearbox.
We want to make it possible not only for the large multinationals to succeed in Kenya, but for our own homegrown innovators to design things that we need here. You know what we do normally, we import generic items. It may or may not fit what we need because it's made in China or India or some of the huge manufacturing centers. But if you manufacture something that's custom made for our needs, the likelihood of success in the business place is much higher. The way forward is really to start getting a lot of small companies to get to international best standard. So, you know, when you think about African or Kenyan products, typically people will think of Jua Kali. They'll think of something that the finish is not really very good, but they kind of just accept it. We want to bring things to world-class finish, world-class performance, and so on.
Speaking at the launch of the new Gearbox lighter facility, Kenya's Industry, Trade and Investment Cabinet Secretary, Adan Muhammad, said the government is keen to promote the spirit of entrepreneurship to provide employment and the requisite skills to create an industrial renaissance.
I'm really impressed, really, really impressed to see some of the things that are being tested here, prototyped. Behind here, you're talking about very, very efficient, clean, cheaper, and convenient cooking, system that is being prototyped here. To see an ATM that is, vending fuel for cooking. Is something that I'm sure 10 years from now people will think that is kind of a normal day-to-day business. But you can't visualize and imagine what that is.
Kenneth Odiambo, an electronics engineer, says that Gearbox provides a unique space for members to showcase innovative ideas and share skills, with also providing a platform for capacity building.
We as engineers help you build your concept. You don't have to be an engineer to come to Gearbox. So long as you have a concept, so long as you can think it, we can make it.
Perhaps even more interesting is Simon Mwaura Kimany, a self-taught engineer and uniquely talented individual, making his mark in the tech community. He's made several innovations and created cutting-edge vehicle tracking systems that has been installed in hundreds of thousands of cars in Kenya.
I'm having about 500 vehicles which are using my devices for now. I have my own fleet management system. And of late now, I'm designing a house automation system whereby the system can be able now to arm itself automatically. You can be able to see the status on your phone. And any intrusion that happens in your house, you can be able to activate any appliances in the house.
Kenya is successfully attracting private equity capital, and international firms are setting up local and regional offices. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States joins the international community in expressing zero tolerance for female genital mutilation, cutting. This practice, said President Barack Obama, harms and holds back entire communities. It has no place in any community and undermines efforts to empower women and girls. At least 200 million women and girls alive today have undergone female genital mutilation. The latest figures from UNICEF show that nearly 70 million more girls than previously thought have been subject to this barbaric practice. Female genital mutilation cutting includes all procedures that involve the partial or total removal of external female genitalia or injury to the female genital organs for non-medical reasons. There is no excuse for such blatant human rights violations of women and girls. As President Obama said, just because this is a tradition in some places does not make it right. This practice is harmful and therefore wrong wherever it occurs. That's why the U.S. has funded programming to combat female genital mutilation and cutting in places like Guinea. At home, the United States has criminalized the transport of girls to undergo female genital mutilation, worked with religious leaders and community-based organizations to raise awareness, especially in some immigrant communities where the pressures to engage in this practice remain, and provided grant opportunities for domestic, non-governmental organizations implementing innovative prevention strategies. The United States stands with communities at home and around the globe working to prevent female genital mutilation and cutting. We call on girls and their families, teachers, health workers, community and religious leaders, and government officials to act together to make a difference, said President Obama. It's time to put an end to this harmful practice and to allow communities everywhere to meet their full potential by enabling women and girls to meet theirs.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk, rumors. Millions are paid to athletes, singers, and actors for their work. Celebrities, do they earn too much money? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing rumors. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa. Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the Uganda presidential elections with Shaka Sali in Uganda and me, Esther Gido Yuart, as the studio guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou discusses female circumcision, also known as female genital cutting. Our guest is Angela M. Peabody, president and founder of Global Woman Peace Foundation. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.